Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Karen Greenberg of New York University's Center on Law and Security, who assesses the methods by which Bush administration officials can be held accountable for their violation of U.S. and international law. Brian Van Slyke of Students for Justice in Palestine at Hampshire College, who explains how his group succeeded in pressuring Hampshire to divest from companies that support the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and journalist and author David Bacon, who asserts that for the labor movement to reverse their declining fortunes, they must revive their past radical social vision. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As Sri Lanka steps up its military offensive to crush the Tamil Tiger separatist rebels, journalists have come to fear for their lives. Concern over press freedom grew after the killing of a leading Sri Lankan journalist, Lasantha Vikramathunga, who was shot in early January by two gunmen driving away on motorcycles. The editor had predicted his own assassination. An unnamed businessman told the Interpress service Vikramathunga was targeted because he was exposing corruption of ministers and bureaucrats. The editor had recently exposed a Sri Lanka government deal to buy MiG fighter jets from Russia. 2 days before Vikramathunga was killed, 15 armed men had attacked the country's largest private television station, MBC Networks. Gunmen had also targeted the home of the founder of the Sri Lanka chapter of Transparency International, who exposes corruption. 3 days after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, African-American resident Donald Harrington was shot without warning. After a second blast, he saw three armed white men shooting at him. Harrington and two friends were attacked in Algiers Point, a predominantly middle-class white enclave surrounded by black neighborhoods. Algiers Point stayed dry during Katrina as nearby levees held. The National Guard designated a nearby ferry landing an official evacuation zone. Fearing scores of refugees from Katrina, the white residents of Algiers Point sealed off the neighborhood, blocking streets with downed trees and lumber. Some residents armed themselves and began patrolling the streets with shotguns on the lookout for thieves, possible looters, and anyone who didn't belong. According to The Nation magazine, 11 black men were shot in the days after Katrina, apparently by white vigilantes. In Harrington's case, nobody filed a police report about the incident until Harrington asked the New Orleans Police Department about it a month later. Forensic pathologist James Traylor, who worked in the New Orleans morgue in the days after Katrina, feels a new investigation must be launched to look into homicides that were not investigated at the time. At first, the Obama White House asked Mark Dybul, head of the Bush administration's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, to stay on to direct the fight against global AIDS. But soon after Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, Dybul was asked to leave. Clinton, with strong ties to reproductive rights advocates, decided the global AIDS czar, with close ties to the religious right, had to go. In the media, Dybul's defenders, like former Bush speechwriter Michael Gerson, cried foul, complaining Obama had caved into women's groups and called the dismissal a mugging. Other activists like Jody Jacobson, an advisor to the reproductive health website RH Reality Check, says Dybul was too close to the religious right and the Bush administration's abstinence-only agenda on sex education. During the 2008 reauthorization of PEPFAR, women's advocates had a running battle with Dybul over abstinence-only funding. Dybul issued a regulation which banned clinics that worked to prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV from buying birth control for their clients. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
In the month since Barack Obama was sworn in as president, the prospects of Congress or the new administration's Department of Justice initiating an investigation into Bush administration lawbreaking have ebbed and flowed. As a candidate and since taking office, President Obama has spoken often about his preference to look forward and not backward at the crimes that may have been committed during the Bush administration, including torture, politicization of the Justice Department, flawed intelligence used to justify the Iraq War, and warrantless surveillance. But Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has expressed guarded support for accountability found in the initiatives of Vermont's Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy and John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan. Leahy, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, wants to establish a truth commission to investigate a host of issues, modeled on the body that investigated the apartheid regime in South Africa. He wants the panel to have subpoena power, but would not bring criminal charges. Conyers, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, wants to establish a commission to look at these same issues, along with an independent criminal probe. Other groups who reject a commission that would likely offer immunity in exchange for testimony as a whitewash have called for Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate and prosecute any and all government officials who have participated in war crimes. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of New York University's Center on Law and Security, who assesses the methods by which Bush administration officials can be held accountable for their violation of U.S. and international law.
It seems that in the little time since Obama became president, all of the signs that he's been giving out, which is I want to look forward, not backwards, I don't want to get into witch hunting, I don't want to be accused of going on a witch hunt against the prior administration, there was sort of a tamping down of any expectations that there would be an investigation, let alone a prosecution. And in the past couple of weeks, the call for some kind of, not just an investigation, but a formal commission has really snowballed in a way that I have to say I wouldn't have expected, but there seems to be a lot of energy in that direction despite what the president is saying. And you know, I'm not sure the president should or needs to lead such an effort.
Let's talk about the vehicle for holding these folks accountable in a moment. But right now, why don't you discuss with the most serious crimes that you believe should be investigated and, you know, accountability should be applied. What are the things that the Bush administration has done, in your view, that require accountability?
Oh, goodness. Because I've spent so much time looking at torture, that would be the one for me that, and it's the one I think most people focus on because it's so egregious. But I do think the use of the Department of Justice for political purposes in the U.S. Attorney's situation is another circumstance that needs to be looked into. I think that the destruction of the tapes needs to be looked into. I think some of the warrantless surveillance needs to be looked into. And I think perhaps if we were really brave, we would look at the path to war in Iraq and who knew what when. But for my purposes, you know, I'm not looking, and I'm not sure many people are, maybe they are, but I'm not concerned with some kind of broad investigation and prosecution. To me, what we really need to look into is the issue of torture and perhaps the tampering with the Justice Department. I think it's enough, and I think that these illegal activities, which were, you know, promoted from the top level, need to be handled in terms of just saying what happened. Prosecutions is actually another step and actually another story. But to make people aware of what happened and to do it in a dispassionate way without a sense of revenge that we have to clean house completely or name, you know, dozens of names, but to say what happened and who made it happen is important if it's not going to happen again.
Karen, what would be your preference with regard to a truth commission or a serious investigation by the Justice Department in prosecution? If you had your pick, what would you choose?
If I had my pick, I would ask for a thorough, quiet, fact-finding commission that did not take prosecution off the table, at least not in a blanket way. And perhaps it could give immunity to some of the lower-level players who could then talk about what happened without any kind of fear of reprisal or a fear of indictment. But I would not take prosecution off the table as people would expect in a truth and reconciliation style commission. And then once all the facts are in, I think some determinations could be made about what to do. I think to guess about the end and to think about prosecution before we've put things into place in a rather calm fashion is not a good place to begin.
Karen, I wanted to ask just a moment here about the importance of accountability, given that the country faces so many intractable problems with the economy, with wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and just, you know, multiple distractions from closely examining and holding people accountable for their misconduct in the past. So maybe we can conclude with that, why we really need to look at the past.
Yes, we have a lot of intractable problems, and yes, we have a limited amount of time and energy and resources, particularly in Washington, to devote to different issues. But, you know, I'm of the opinion that taking some serious time to examine what went on in the past is important because these things are all related. The torture issue is not separate from decisions that were made about Afghanistan and Iraq or about our alliances with Europe and the rest of the world. And I think that the more you look into any of these issues, you're going to find the same pattern over and over. An idea of sort of abusing the interagency process, excluding people who needed to be at the table but who were left out of the table. I mean, little things like that went on that you don't want happening going forward if you're going to have a strong, unified, knowledgeable federal government. So I would say that picking something to investigate is incredibly important in terms of understanding how to go forward. And so I don't see it as a distraction so much as a way of learning how to do things better and maybe even constructively as we approach the future.
That was Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of New York University's Center on Law and Security. Visit the center's website at lawandsecurity.org. Read her article, The People versus Dick Cheney, at motherjones.com. Greenberg is author of the forthcoming book, The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days. On February 7th, Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, became the first college in the U.S. to have its board of trustees vote to divest from holdings in companies that support the Israeli occupation of Palestine. The vote was the result of a two-year campaign by Students for Justice in Palestine. It should be noted that when the board acted, the board president and the college president issued a clarification that the divestment decision was made without reference to any country or political movement. Among the companies students recommended for divestment due to their financial interest in the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land are Caterpillar, General Electric, ITT, Motorola, Terex, and United Technologies. In response, Alan Dershowitz, a prominent supporter of Israeli policy, has threatened to initiate an international campaign to divest from Hampshire College. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Brian Van Slyke, a junior at Hampshire and a coordinator of Students for Justice in Palestine. He is also the elected student member of the Board of Trustees with voting power. Van Slyke describes the successful campaign, which resulted in the college divesting of approximately 20% of its $30 million portfolio. And he provides a possible explanation for the college officials' denials of targeting the Israeli occupation.
We had a petition that we signed that over 800 members of the community. Most of that was students, and we have a very small campus. So we did other things on the campus, such as campus organizing by having educational events, having movie screenings, dialogues, bringing people to do speeches, protests and rallies, especially when things erupted in Gaza, vigils. We set up a few times a mock wall on the library lawn, which is the main center of campus, and handed every student different types of passports, Palestinian passports, Israeli passports, and treated them differently and made them come see the realities of the wall and life in the West Bank. And we reached out to other colleges, surrounding colleges. But then we did a lot of internal work within the Board of Trustees. We stacked the ballot for student reps to the Board of Trustees in each committee and the trustees themselves, and we got in almost every single position a student on our side elected. We really pushed this through the Board of Trustees for about 9 months after we introduced it, and it eventually was accepted. And for the 9 months until almost, you know, only days before this was approved by the Board of Trustees, the only six companies that were discussed were the six companies identified by SJP that were invested in, that contributed to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And only days before that happened were other companies looked at. So, yeah, this was a direct result of student pressure.
And what are those six companies?
Those six companies were United Technologies, General Electric, Motorola, Terex, ITT, and Caterpillar. The administration actually asked SJP to identify all companies that were involved in the occupation. And we gave them a list of 20 companies which were involved in the occupation, and they divested from the six that we were invested in, and they didn't invest in the other 14. So this just goes to show that the occupation was a large part and the moving part of this divestment.
Brian Van Slyke, the president of the Board of Trustees and the president of the college has certainly put a different spin on their divestment decision than what you just said. They put out a statement that the board accepted the report of its investment committee that voted, quote, without reference to any country or political movement, to transfer assets held in a State Street fund to another fund, unquote. The statement said that the review showed that, quote, this fund held stocks in well over 200 companies engaged in business practices that violate the college's policy on socially responsible investments. These violations include unfair labor practices, environmental abuse, military weapons manufacturing, and unsafe workplace settings. Why do you think they spun it this way?
Why they're saying that now is because of pressure from outside people like Alan Dershowitz, and, you know, they just got cold feet. But for 9 months, the only six companies that were talked about were the six companies identified by SJP. And we have internal documents, meeting minute notes and everything, since we were on all the committees that, you know, proved this. So, you know, what if our anti-occupation movement helped us divest from other companies along the way? We're totally psyched about that, too. Other bad companies we don't want to be invested in.
So what does Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz, who's a militant supporter of Israel, have to do with this?
Only a matter of hours after we went public, Alan Dershowitz actually personally called SJP members, the SJP spokespeople, including myself, and threatened them, personally threatened them in the college. We don't know how he got contact information, but he called us and he threatened us, and then after that he called it and he made a huge threat at the college that he was going to organize a boycott campaign of the college. He was going to organize international divestment of the college. He was going to organize a personal boycott of us individually. I'm not sure how you do that, but he was going to do things like that. So there's been a lot of pressure from people like him to discredit SJP.
What is your group doing going forward? Are you in touch with students at other colleges who want their schools to divest from the occupation?
You know, we're still trying to get our message and our argument out there. We still got a lot of things to say about this. We still got to talk about it, and we're trying to make it far and wide and reach our audience of other activists and other student groups who want to organize divestment campaigns at their colleges. So we're really still trying to get out there. We're trying to figure out ways that we can work with other colleges and help them, you know, look at our model and see what they could adapt from what we did and apply it to their college and things like that. We're also trying to do a lot of fundraising for our college because people like Alan Dershowitz are trying to organize a boycott of the college. We're a pretty fragile institution. We're a very small college. So that could be seriously damaging to us. So we're trying to organize fundraising for the college so that no one could make an example of us, so that we could really serve as a shining example of how to divest from the occupation.
That was Brian Van Slyke of Students for Justice in Palestine at Hampshire College. For more information, visit the group's website at hsjp.org or email them at hampshiresjp@gmail.com. As the U.S. and much of the world suffers through one of the worst economic downturns in 80 years, the U.S. labor movement continues to experience declining membership at a time when workers need protection more than ever. The decision of workers at Chicago's Republic Windows and Doors plant, who organized a successful sit-in to fight for severance and vacation pay after the plant closed on December 5th last year, was an inspiration to many union members. The action was a reminder of labor militancy that forced the recognition of unions nationwide during the years of the Great Depression. Membership in unions has declined from 35% of the U.S. workforce after World War II to just 12% today. The loss of union members and the power that comes with it has been a major factor in the decline of the American middle class and growing disparity between the nation's rich and poor. One piece of legislation that will be considered by the new Congress is the Labor-Backed Employee Free Choice Act, a bill that would allow a majority of workers to more easily gain union recognition. But labor journalist David Bacon maintains that a few changes to federal labor law are not enough. In his recent article titled "A Radical Vision for Today's Labor Movement, The Importance of Internationalism and Civil Rights," Bacon asserts that labor must better educate their members to the dangers of corporate-led globalization, question the priorities of our society, and make links between U.S. foreign policy and the declining power of unions. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Bacon about his view that labor needs to revive its past radical social vision to inspire a reversal of their fortunes.
We're in some ways still suffering the effects of the Cold War, because it was really the Cold War and the McCarthyite period and the anti-communism of the 1950s that basically drove out of the labor movement, to begin with, most of those people who had an independent point of view about how to organize workers and what the purpose of organizing workers should be, and then created a situation in which the leadership of our movement essentially supported U.S. foreign policy around the world. That kind of got to be a crisis by the time we hit the Reagan administration, because on the one hand you had Reagan attacking unions here at home and the PATCO strike, which sort of enshrined the ability of unions to use strike breakers legally. So here was Ronald Reagan attacking labor, attacking workers on the one hand, and then engaging in these wars in Central America especially that were putting down those movements that people organized in order to try and gain some degree of social justice in those countries. Here in the U.S., immigration has become a very controversial subject among working people. In part, I think the controversy is because we have not really helped people to understand how globalization works. What are the forces that force people out of their countries of origin in places like Central America, and what that has to do with U.S. foreign policy. In other words, when U.S. foreign policy supports right-wing governments that increase poverty in countries like El Salvador and then use very brutal military means to keep those governments in power, that forces people to leave those countries and come here to the United States. So we see huge movements of migrants around the world. And this is not just El Salvador or Central America to the United States. These kinds of economic pressures on people exist in poor countries around the world. And people are going not just from Mexico and Central America to the U.S., but from Turkey to Germany, or from the Philippines to Japan, or from North Africa to France, all for pretty much the same set of economic and political reasons. It's time that we really talked honestly to working people in this country about what the reasons for the displacement of people in poor countries around the world is, and what this has to do with our foreign policy, because we have to have a much more independent and a much more critical point of view about U.S. foreign policy and our labor movement than we've had for the last 50 years.
We are in the depths of an economic crisis. And in your article, you talk about how during the 1930s, during the Great Depression, the labor movement was an engine for social change in a very progressive direction. What are the dangers and opportunities right now in this current economic crisis in the United States for the labor movement as you see it?
Well, I think the big danger is that we sit on our hands. I think there's too much right now in the labor movement of kind of sitting and waiting for Obama to sort of save the day. And I give, President Obama credit for saying that we need to create 4 million new jobs in this country. I think that's a very good thing that we have a president who's willing to say that. That was certainly different from Bush, and you know, McCain certainly would have been very different from that had he been elected. But I don't think that the administration is even going to create those 4 million jobs, much less end the war in Iraq, much less pull out of Afghanistan, much less not negotiate new free trade treaties, much less inaugurate a new era of civil rights for people of color, including African Americans and immigrants here, without us, without our pushing on them. And I think that it's not a good sign, for instance, that we haven't yet had any kind of major national march or demonstration in Washington about unemployment and the foreclosures. You know, these are our members who are losing jobs and losing houses. Why aren't we out there in the streets? If this were Mexico, we would have had a couple of demonstrations with 1 million people in Mexico City already by now. And I think that it's not a good idea that we just sort of think that we can kind of negotiate with the administration without having some effort to mobilize our own members and put people into the street and protest over the effects of this economic crisis. And I think once people also get out into the street and start moving, this is a time when we can also help to educate people about why this economic crisis happened to us to begin with and what are some kind of much more longer range, deep answers to the crisis than just simply throwing more money at the banks.
What kind of lessons do you think the American worker can take from those activists in the United Electrical Workers Union who took over the plant at Republic Windows and Doors?
Well, the first lesson is fighting is a good thing. You know, much better to fight for your job and to fight for your severance pay than to just let them take your job away and walk out of your plant in defeat. You know, the big thing that those workers did there was that when the company said to them, hey, we're not going to pay you any severance pay, your job is over, just get out of here, they said, no, we're not. Because what the Republic workers really said, I think, that is really the most important message is, and that is we have a right to our jobs, but we're only going to be able to win that right if we stand up and fight for it.
That was labor journalist and photographer David Bacon. Read his article, A Radical Vision for Today's Labor Movement, online at dbacon.igc.org. He is also author of the new book titled Illegal People, How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Immigrants. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.